This podcast is sponsored by Sophie Reaptress. I saw some creative cave suits this past weekend, and I even saw a group going in there, and my apologies if you were in this group, but a group wearing Tyvek suits, like those protective Tyvek suits you'll see at like chemical plants. And I mean, yeah, I'm sure that that'll keep your clothes from getting dirty, but I wouldn't call them abrasion resistant. But Sophie's cave suits, man, they are made with Sophie's caving experience in mind, and she does a great job. 500 denier Cordura all over the thing, twice as thick where you need it, knees, butts, elbows, and she'll make it to your exact specifications. You want a pocket there? She'll put a pocket there. You want a bat stencil? She'll put one right there, wherever you want it. They come in a variety of colors as well. Just go to the website, which is up in the show notes of this podcast, and order up. You can also find her on Instagram at Sophie Reaptress. If you find the one with more than 30,000 followers, you found the right one, because she knows what she's doing. She's a one-woman business, and she'll make you a great cave suit. SophieReaptress.com. And again, I've got a link in the description, the show notes of this podcast. Welcome to the Caving Podcast. My name is Matt Pelser. I am a member of the Central Indiana Grotto. Or am I? All right, I'm going to come clean here. I didn't realize it until I got my most recent newsletter that I have let my membership lapse for over a year. I'm going to make that up with extra dues for 2022, and I am ashamed of that fact. So this is my admission, public admission, that I am putting out there as a reminder to you to pay your dues. I mean, nobody in my grotto has the time to chase down delinquent dues, and so I didn't know until recently that I was behind on that. It's an honest mistake, but make up for it, you know? And maybe kick a few extra bucks towards your grotto, or pay for several years in advance. Sometimes your treasurers will allow for that. That's probably what I'll do. What's a grotto? Great question. If you're new to caving, a grotto is a local chapter of our national organization, the NSS, the National Speleological Society. If you would like to find your grotto, you can do that through the NSS website. And I've got a link in the show notes to help you find that. And we highly recommend that you do your caving through a grotto, because there are lots of safety protocols that are very important to us cavers, so that we don't have to go out on a rescue and find you. And there are a few safety protocols. I won't name them all here, but they're there for a reason. And if you like going caving enough, you really should be part of a grotto so you can meet other people and do some really cool stuff. So consider doing that. This month, my guest is Joel Despain, editor of the NSS News, along with Adam Weaver. They're kind of tackling it together, and we'll get into that in a little bit. I almost forgot. I gave you some bad information. It was either last month or the month before, maybe even both. I don't know. But I had said that Sarah was Mother's Day weekend. It is not. It is the first weekend in May. And I've got a link where you can pre-register for Sarah, put on by the Nashville Grotto, in the show notes. And if you're keeping track at home, that is May 4th through the 7th, not May 11th through the 14th. All right, May 4th through the 7th. And I am planning on being there to go caving and to hopefully do some more interviews for the podcast in person. So that'll be cool. So pre-register for Sarah. It's open now. I did go caving this past month. Thank you to Jeff Gosnell of the Near Normal Grotto. Went caving with a bunch of Illinois cavers. Had a great time in Buckner Cave. I took a small adventurous group through Keene's Grotto, which is a very tight alternate route around the Buckner Circle route. And turns out we went the hard way. I mean, if you go through Keene's Grotto, it's hard. But of the kind of two options that you've got with Keene's Grotto, we went the tighter way. And we didn't realize that until we were all the way through it. I mean, this is like belly to the ground, back to the ceiling. Decide which way you're going to have your head turned before you go in there, because you're committed once you get in there. And I mean, I don't know exactly how far you have to crawl that way. I mean, I want to say 35, 40 feet. I could be wrong. It probably felt like that, but maybe it wasn't that long. But great time. Great time. Some hardy cavers in that group, and I appreciated it. And thank you, Jeff, for the invitation and for organizing and getting everybody out there. And then, of course, this past weekend, it was a huge honor to give the keynote speech at Carter Cave State Resort Park's Winter Adventure Weekend, which had record attendance. More than 500 people came out, and did cave trips and rappelling and rope climbing and squeeze box and what they call the corrugated cave, which is like a cave simulator. Just had a great time. I went to Bat Cave, did the Bat Cave Extreme trip with Coy Ainslie, who was the person who asked me to be the keynote speaker. Marshall Ainslie, his son, was at the back of the group, and he and I had a good time, and he introduced me for the keynote speech, which was very nice. Thank you to Paul Tierney and the Friends of Carter Caves for getting this whole thing going, and it was good to run into some people. It was good to run into Kelly McDermott, who I went caving with at Roppel, and Cat Bishop. I bought Cat's book, The James Cave Project, 60 Years Inside Bald Knob, and cannot wait to dig into it. And if I ran into you and I didn't mention your name, I'm sorry. It was just a big weekend and I had the best time. And my wife had a good time too. It was nice to drop the kids off with her folks and enjoy a weekend together. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. What a huge honor to be able to do that. And the presentation went really well. And this past month I talked to the Bear Grotto in Texas. And if you are in charge of presentations for your grotto, I'm happy to do that. If time allows, I do go to bed early, but depending on what time your meeting is, I do love giving virtual presentations. I'm doing one for the Bloomington, Indiana grotto next week. So do let me know. My email address is alpineproductions@gmail.com, and you can find me on Facebook too. Okay, let's get to it. Joel Despain, he is the new editor of the NSS News, took over from Dave Bunnell at the beginning of this year. Well, I mean, late last year, kind of, but his first issue was the January issue, and he's working with Adam Weaver, and we'll get into the specifics of how they're dividing up the work here right off the bat here. He finds caves out west. He's managed caves for the National Park Service and the National Forest Service. He's worked for NCRI, which is an acronym that we drop a few times, and I don't think we ever explained what it is. Cavers know, but if you don't know, it's National Cave and Karst Research Institute. Joel has done an awful lot, and I had such a wonderful time talking to him. Here is me and Joel Despain. How'd you get roped into editing the NSS News?
Well, I have an undergraduate degree in journalism, so cave publications, cave articles, cave magazines are always something I've been interested in, always something I've worked on. I've done a few caving books along the way, too. So once Dave decided to retire, once Dave Bunnell decided to retire, I thought, hey, this could be a good retirement gig. You know, it's a part-time position. It's something I enjoy doing. It's something I have experience in. So it seemed like a good fit. And luckily, the NSS leadership agreed and gave me the job, or really half the job. Of course, my partner, Adam Weaver, he's handling the production end of things, and I'm handling the content end of things. And Dave previously had handled both of those together.
Okay, can you break down that split a little more? I've had Adam on the podcast, and he was a delight. So what is he doing versus what you're doing?
Adam is really focused on the look and the layout. So he's in working in the InDesign software. He's really responsible for the great new look of the magazine. So he's kind of putting it all together. And then I'm responsible for content. So I'm editing the content that comes in. I'm talking to members to get them to send us stuff. I'm working with people to get their photo captions. You know, trying to plan out a few months ahead to make sure we've got plenty of content coming in. So that kind of stuff is what I'm handling.
So in your experience thus far, what would you say, because a lot of NSS members listen to this, what would you say is a need for the NSS News? I mean, I'm guessing that you're always in need of good content, but I know that where my grotto is concerned, the Central Indiana grotto, it's always been, you know, a handful of people contributing on a consistent basis. And we just kind of put in whatever we get in with the newsletter. What's it look like on the national level?
Honestly, it's not terribly different. Yeah. We tend to publish what we get in. Now, certainly I will go out and solicit people. You know, if I know somebody's got some big new breakthrough or, you know, a conservancy's bought a new cave, then we'll definitely reach out at times. And the NSS convention can be important that way, because there we can go and see what people are up to, you know, check in on all the presentations and all the programs. And that's a great opportunity to say, hey, why don't you go ahead and convert this cool project into an article for the news? So generally, we kind of publish what comes in, but we also try to reach out and bring in stuff that's going to be interesting to the membership.
So if someone then is working on something that they would like a few more eyes on, which doesn't always happen. I mean, you and I both know the caving world can be kind of secretive, but when people are ready to announce what they have done or are doing, I don't know, what are their chances of getting into the NSS News, or how would they better their chances, I guess, of getting into the publication?
Honestly, it's rare for us to turn something down. It may be delayed for a month or two. Like right now, we have a lot of content. In fact, I just was kind of working through it yesterday. We're probably booked up till about August with the content we currently have or what we know is coming in. And so you may need to wait a while if we've got a lot of content at the time that you submit something. But generally, if you send it in, we're going to try to publish it. If it's you've got the enough interest and motivation to write it up, we're going to try to get it in. Now, there's some standards we don't, you know, we have to adhere to, and some things we want to be careful about. We want to maintain high standards for the magazine. But for the most part, we publish what we get.
What insight did Dave give you when he handed the torch over? Did he say, you know, no one's going to tell you this, but XYZ?
You know, there wasn't a lot of that. You know, I've known Dave a very long time. He's a very open guy. The caving community is a very open community. I talked to him about producing the news numerous times over the years. He and I cave together pretty often. And so we've had a lot of conversations along the way. So I don't think there are any particular big secrets. I mean, really, I think our biggest challenge is Dave's shoes are pretty big ones to fill.
Yeah.
If you look back at what the NSS news looked like when Dave started and how it looked like when he ended, it's a revolution. It's a completely different thing. You know, he got in all the, it wasn't in color before Dave did that. You know, the articles were really different before Dave kind of put some standards in there. So I think we got a challenge just to kind of keep up with Dave and, you know, maintain a really good publication. Now, I will say that I feel like Adam's work to kind of modernize and sort of simplify the look of the news, I think it's been really positive and really great. And so that's probably going to be one of the primary things that's different in terms of what Adam and I are doing going forward. I don't expect the content to change much, but the look is changing pretty radically.
Okay. So that kind of answers my next question. Like what do you think is going to be different? It sounds like not a whole lot. I am excited to see what Adam brings to the table where that's concerned, but like, when you took it on, was there anything you had in mind for things that you would like to see, maybe different features, new features, or are we just kind of in a maintenance mode right now until we kind of get our hands dirtier with it?
Yeah, I would say that that is the case. We didn't have any really kind of burning desire to change the content or to make any big differences. Mm. I have heard over the years, you get sort of the perspective from people that, okay, we've got, you know, another article about someplace that's 5,000 miles away that's in the middle of nowhere where I'm never going to go, and I'm not really all that interested in these caves. And I think that's a reasonable perspective. Now, we also, of course, get the opposite. I'm never going to go there, so I'm glad to see pictures of these caves that are 5,000 miles away. So we do want to encourage national content, perhaps a little bit more local content, you know, significant milestones for grottos, significant things for conservancies, activities in the region. We're open to publishing more of those sorts of things than perhaps Dave generally did, but we don't have a lot of that sort of content. So I've got to encourage people to get that stuff into us. But I think overall, our primary thing that we're really right off the bat looking to change was the appearance and the layout. Adam has taken the lead on that, as I've said, and he's done a great job, but I'm really supportive of it. I really wanted to see those changes too, and I'm really happy with what Adam has been able to accomplish.
Have you been doing it long enough to be able to say, this is a common email that I will get, or this is a common criticism that the news will get? And have you been working on it, or can you work on any of these things that you've been hearing about, any of these criticisms? Like, I have heard that often before where it's like, hey, we're talking too much about international stuff. Why aren't we talking about stuff in the United States? Well, the answer is because it's really cool what's happening internationally, and maybe you should check it out. But I don't know. Is there anything like that that you see a lot of?
I wouldn't say consistently yet. I mean, we're only working on the March issue, and we started with the January, so we're still really new at this. So, and I don't think I've received a single criticism yet. People have generally been really supportive and really encouraging.
That's great.
And of course, as I said before, we publish what we get in. So if people want to see different things, then write it up and send it in, and we will be happy to publish it. One thing to remember, too, is that for a lot of our international work and also our national expeditions that receive sponsorship from the NSS, as part of getting a grant from the NSS, you're required to either produce an article for the news or to make a presentation at convention. So part of the reason that we get all this international stuff is because they have to. They're supposed to send us an article.
Yeah.
And so that's a strong encouragement because they want to be able to get grants in the future. So that's part of the reason why we get so much of the international content. But of course, we're not limited to that. And if people want to see something different, then please write an article and send it in.
There you go. That's what we always heard when we would be in Grotto meetings, and they'd be like, why are we always hearing from the same person? And the reason is because you're not writing anything, man.
Well, that's it, you know?
Yeah, write about what you're doing and send it in. It's just that simple.
It is. It is really that simple. Our content is driven by our membership and what they want to see in the magazine. So if you want to see something different, send it our way.
All right. So, Joel, you used to teach cave recreation.
I still do.
You still do. How do you teach such a thing, and where at?
I teach a class for California State University, Northridge.
Okay.
The recreation department. They have a series of classes in the department that focus on outdoor sports and recreation. The thing that we forget is that, of course, you know, we go caving for fun with our friends and go do our caving projects. But for millions of Americans, millions of people around the world, going on cave tours and going and doing a little wild caving, maybe just once or twice in their lives, is a big recreational opportunity. There's hundreds of commercial caves in the United States. I don't know, maybe a couple hundred, something like that. And they have, you know, millions of visitors each year. Billions of dollars are spent. Cave recreation is actually a huge industry. And so the class focuses on that. We talk about the history of cave tourism, the history of commercial caves, the economic impacts, and all these sorts of things that are involved with the commercial cave and the cave tourism world. And then we also do take the students out and give them a caving experience. So we do a weekend field trip. We go to a show cave. We've gone to a couple different ones where they can see, you know, how the operation works, what the tours are like, how people work with the visitors, the facilities and infrastructure. And then we take them caving. And again, they get to experience, you know, a kind of wild cave and have a caving experience. Now, these students are from Los Angeles. Northridge is part of the greater Los Angeles area in Southern California. And say that they don't get a chance for a lot of outdoor and recreational opportunities, even though a lot of them are recreation majors who take the class. So for a lot of the kids, it's a good experience. They're a little challenged. We have a lot of fun. And even in the very least, we end up with a cadre of students who appreciate caves and understand them a lot better. I've taught the class for maybe 12 years now. It's been a while.
That is super interesting. So you get into like the business of show caves and things like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you bet. You bet. I mean, it's a college course. And of course, the National Caves Association, you know, are kind of an NSS partner that runs and the Association of Show Cave Owners and Tour Operators in the country. You know, their webpage is a great source of information about the economic impacts. So there's a lot of good information out there. But yeah, we teach the business of cave tours and cave management.
Oh, my gosh. That's some fascinating stuff. I mean, I should be more curious about that. And I've talked to Gary Robertson, who owns Indiana Caverns and owned, Marengo and helped develop Squire Boone Caverns here in Indiana, but I didn't ever talk to him about like the business of it. And maybe to me, it would feel too personal to ask him some of these questions, but I don't know. Do you go into like typical profit margins or other things that maybe wouldn't necessarily be top of mind for cavers thinking about show caves and running a show cave?
We don't go into the specific details that say profit margins for an individual operation. But we do talk about profitability, you know, and one of the things we emphasize is how a lot of recreational cave operations now have a wild tour or an adventure tour, and how that's been a really positive thing for the bottom line at a lot of commercial cave operations. So we talk about that. We talk about, you know, insurance and the challenges there. We talk about the challenges of lighting caves and managing your cave lighting system. We talk about hiring tour guides and how to train them. So we talk about all these sorts of different things and, you know, try to cover that. But it's, you know, I don't say we don't get super in depth in terms of specific numbers or things like that.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, so it's not really that kind of class, but that's still, I mean, I've heard of, you know, cavers retiring from their 9 to 5 and then becoming tour guides at show caves. You know, our own Dave Everton here in Indiana, he ended up working for, he retired from Indiana University and ended up working at Blue Spring Caverns, the boat tour here in Indiana, which I would love to go on a Dave Everton boat tour at Blue Spring. Yeah, I mean, that's really cool. So I don't know where that's concerned. What do you talk about in this class that might be of surprise to cavers? I don't know, not to put you on the spot or anything, but.
Well, I think probably, you know, cavers are outdoorsy people. They often have a lot of experience in the outdoors. And so with these students, we have to start really basic because these students are very much urban young people, and they just haven't had any experience in the outdoors.
Yeah.
So sometimes you have to talk about some really basic things like, okay, I need to go to the restroom and we're in the woods because they've never really thought about that. Or, you know, and thought about, okay, we've got to talk about how to deal with that because we're going to be out in the woods, and just things, just things that might seem really common sense to cavers, we have to be more clear about with these students because they just don't have these experiences. So sometimes we talk about things that almost seem kind of inane, but are necessary to make sure that the students are prepared.
And you're a cave specialist for the Park Service, right? So you've got
You were.
Okay. So that's no longer, but you've got some real experience where, where that's concerned. So what about that? So you did that for almost 3 decades?
Yeah. Between the Forest Service and the Park Service. Yep. I did 29 years working for the federal government in cave management.
So what was that like? What'd you have to do?
Well, of course, when we talk about managing caves, or what I talk about a lot as an analogy, you know, we hire people that we call them bear technicians. And because they try to keep people and the bears separate, and we hire people and we call them cave technicians. And really, when you're a bear technician or you're a cave technician, the focus isn't really on the bears or on the caves, it's on the people.
Right.
Because the people are what you're challenged to, you know, you're trying to keep them well behaved so there are no problems. So for cave management, you're trying to do things like say, okay, we think this cave can handle parties of up to 4 people. Okay, well, this delicate passage needs to be flagged off. Well, this cave gate has been broken into. We need to fix it. We need to refurbish it. We need to get it in better shape. So those things like that are what we do with ongoing with cave management in terms of trying to, you know, corral people, keep people doing the right thing, keep people from causing damage or issues. And it really gets a lot like what the Park Service and the Forest Service does with bear techs too. You don't really work with the bears. You work with the campers and the tourists to try to keep them from having their food get hijacked by the bears.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in natural resource management, what you're really doing is managing people.
Yeah.
And so that's really what I did was, you know, try to let cavers come to the park, encourage cavers to come do research and exploration, but at the same time, limit the impacts. And in many cases, undo the impacts. You know, we did a lot of cave restoration projects, clean things up that have been muddied over the decades and undo unnecessary development at the Tura Cave. And so that was also a big aspect of it. And I do try to bring that cave management experience forward in my class for Cal State Northridge and share that with the students and share those experiences and all those different aspects of what's involved in cave management.
And when you're managing things like this, it's best when things stay kind of boring, right? When people are behaving, when people are following the rules and things like that. But in your 27 years, I'm sure that you've got more than a few examples of it going really wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Things can go south, but yeah, you do want things to be a little boring, a little routine, but yeah, we've had, you know, huge problems of cave vandalism, cave rescues. And honestly, one of the other big challenges, it's something I'm grappling with right now, it's, you know, we're all excited and very interested in finding new caves and doing cave exploration. It's, you know, an ongoing thing worldwide. But for a cave manager, then you've got a whole other cave to take care of and a whole other cave you need to protect, a whole other cave you need to consider. So every time there's a new cave, you got to go back to square one and think about what are we going to do here? What's the best thing? How do we protect this one? How do we let people see it while protecting it? So new caves are exciting and were fun, but they're a big challenge.
Are you working then with the explorers who are finding these caves and being like, hey, glad you found it. Can you tell me about it? What needs to be, you know, do we need to gate this? Any of these things?
Well, I'm definitely, you know, I I do the NSS news. I teach this caving class, but I'm retired now, so I have a lot of free time. So I'm a very active caver.
Sure,
I
mean, sure.
I was out caving yesterday, and I'm going to be out caving tomorrow. And my wife is an incredibly skilled ridge walker. She keeps finding new caves where we live in Northern California. These are Forest Service caves. And so it seems like every 3 months, I've got to call the Forest Service guys and be like, we meet at this little restaurant. It's like, okay, guys, we have to go have another burrito and talk about this other new cave we found. It's exciting. It's fun. And it's wonderful. But it's also challenging. My wife found a really interesting new cave just a couple of days ago. We're really excited about it. We've got like a virgin 150-foot deep pit. And I'm like, yeah, oh yeah, we dug into this thing, howling airflow, well decorated. I mean, we're jazzed. But part of me in the back of my mind is like, oh God, now we got to manage this thing and protect it and make sure it stays good. You know, so it's we all have that responsibility, I feel. You know, we all like to go find caves, but you can't find it and just walk away.
Right.
You know, we as cavers, as cave explorers, we all need to make sure the caves we found are cared for and managed, you know, and that also that there's an even playing field for people who want to come see the cave. You know, cavers sometimes get shut out. Cavers sometimes keep secrets from each other. But certainly, you know, long term, you want there to be even access, particularly for a cave on public land like the ones we're finding now on Forest Service property.
I'm really, really glad that you brought that up because I'm curious about this now. Do you find that a cave like that, you know, 150-foot pit, if there's a vertical element, that's kind of a nerd filter, right? Like you're not going to get the vandalism that you're going to get in a horizontal passage.
I think that's generally true. Although I must say I've been surprised at times at what people will do. We have a well-known cave up in our area called Samwell. It's a cave that's very important to the local Native American community. And for quite a few years, and it's got an 80-foot drop in it that's actually a little tricky. It's kind of like an antlion trap. It's this big sloping hole to the pit. So you got to be a little careful at the top. And for years, the Forest Service would just kind of give the key to anybody. And sure enough, people hauled cans of spray paint down the 80-foot pit to write their names on the walls. You just wouldn't think that would happen. But sure enough, it has. And so, you know, now we're trying to get that all cleaned up. So generally, I think pits are certainly nerd filters, but not as much as I wish they were, at least in the case of Samwell Cave. It's sometimes people who know how to go up and on a rope still do not know how to act in a cave and how to respect it. That's clearly the case.
That's a shame. Well, and you would think that if these people, and I don't know if this is the case, if these people went through the trouble of getting permits and having their name on lists to then go and do that where they could easily be found out.
Well, the Forest Service wasn't quite as careful about it. At that time, this is not the case now. At that time, you could just walk into the office and they'd just give you the key. So you didn't even actually have to fill out any paperwork. Now, I think these days to get that key, you're going to have to fill out some paperwork and they're going to have your name.
Yeah, you know, because of people like that.
Yeah. You know, the Forest Service tried to make it really open. It didn't work. And now the cave is generally closed even. So which is kind of a shame because responsible cavers can't go. And, you know, we're stuck with the fallout from the people doing stupid stuff.
Yeah. So you retired from NCRI? You were a cave management scientist there?
Yeah. Not for too long. I was just at NCRI a couple of years. I did that after my Park Service and Forest Service career for a little while. Worked for George Vinney down at NCRI.
Yeah.
Great experience. Great organization. I've got some health issues, and I have some reasons I need to be around home, like my parents' health issues.
Yeah.
And NCRI is a lot of travel. It's very ongoing. It's very intensive. And I just kind of found it wasn't going to be for me and for my family and my kind of life situation right now. So after not too long, I went ahead and retired, and George Vinney was super supportive of that. He understood. And now Pat Sizer is in the position that I was in and seems to be doing great. She's going gangbusters. She's got lots of projects going on. They did rearrange the job a little bit after I left, and I think it's a little bit better, more functional kind of situation. So she's based out of Denver now. And is doing great things. I think Pat's going to do a really good job there.
I had George Vinney on the podcast, which was really, really nice. And he spent the whole hour just talking about NCRI and what they're doing. And it was a wonderful talk. So, I mean, you weren't there very long, but among the things that you did while you were there, I don't know, what would you say highlight wise?
Well, the focus of the position is to actually help the National Park Service with cave management issues.
Ah, oh, so you were already doing that.
Yeah, and that's why I was really qualified for the job at the time, of course. And that's why Pat was really qualified, because she has a lot of experience with cave management, too, in the Carlsbad area and also here in Northern California at Lava Beds. So during that time, we were working with all sorts of different parks. And it's not just caves. It's also very much karst. So we were there was a little park in Arizona that had some big sinkhole problems we were working with. Oregon Caves National Monument has got, they have a very unusual situation with a cave that was found and that then the entrance collapsed and they're trying to figure out what to do with that. So we were working with them. We worked a lot with the National Office on developing Park Service web pages and trying to beef those up and improve those. And really just kind of being available to the parks, lots and lots of phone calls. You know, it's expensive to go on a site visit. So you spend a lot of time on the phone, conference calls, you know, look, we've got this problem. What are some ideas for trying to help us move forward here? So lots of consultation, lots of communication, and just trying to be available to help the park to make good decisions when they may not have a, you know, these smaller parks, they don't have a big enough staff to have their own cave specialist. So they're a little in the dark when they have a sudden sinkhole collapse or they find a new cave. So that's why they need that national office person to kind of step in. You know, for Carlsbad and Wind and Jewel, they've got staff.
Right.
But lots of other parks have caves. You know, there's about 100 parks have caves of some sort of variety or karst features. And for most of those, they need that extra information and that extra knowledge when they have a cave or karst problem or issue.
So then, okay, when you were working with NCRI, or maybe you were handed this from someone who had to deal with this before, when a park that has a cave or a few caves that didn't maybe necessarily have this consultant on, I don't know what you'd say, retainer or whatever, I don't know, from NCRI or an organization like that, and we're having issues with their cave or caves, what do? They just find you and come to you and say, hey, what do we do about this? Because most of the time, I mean, as you and I both know, not a lot of people know a lot about caves.
Yeah. Yes, that is actually kind of what it boils down to. Now, within the Park Service, they have something called the Geologic Resources Division. And that's who Pat Sizer works with, and that's who I worked with. So they're kind of the overarching body for geologic resources in the Park Service. And people are where they exist. They are based in Denver. And so they'll help with paleontology questions. Or like after all this flooding we've been having here in California, some of our national parks, those folks are going to be helping them to rebuild their bridges and deal with the hydrologic issues and the geomorphology issues. They're also really involved with oil and gas issues. There are some national parks where there are oil and gas issues because there's oil and gas drilling adjacent to the parks or even some old wells that still exist in the parks. Mm. Also, a lot of parks have abandoned mines. And those things can be hazardous. They can produce, you know, very hazardous water. Very acidic water can flow from mines. And so the Park Service deals with all of that, too. So the Geologic Resources Division does all that kind of stuff, as well as cave and karst management. And so people are used to going there and asking for questions and asking for help. And so they know, like, okay, we got a little park. We don't understand these mines. We got to go ask the Geologic Resources Division folks. And it's the same way with the caves.
The stuff that NCRI does, I mean, it's just, it's sort of all-encompassing, and I'm just really...
very broad.
Yeah, very. I'm very impressed at what they're doing on all levels. You know, education, too. I mean, I had Deborah on the podcast, and she's doing a bang-up job there, too.
Deborah is such a... You know, Deborah is an energetic, intelligent person. She gets stuff done.
Yeah. In you know, 10 minutes of talking to her, I'm like, all right, yeah, she's the one for this.
Yeah, she's a great person to have in that position. I'm sure she's only been there maybe a year or so now, but I'm sure she's going to do great stuff for NCRI in that job. I mean, she's a very experienced educator and very experienced caver, a great person for it.
Mm-hmm. A lot of tough experience, too. She's sustained a few injuries in her outdoor world.
Yes, she has.
She's a brave one. She's a brave one, that one.
It doesn't hold her back.
No, it doesn't. No. All right, well, I got to sit this one out for a little while, but then I'm back to it as soon as possible.
She had that nasty ankle break, I guess it was, and but no, you don't hold back Deborah for very long.
19 weeks in Lech?
Well, yeah, but I mean, honestly, that's not big. That's not a big number.
Is that not a big number? I mean, I know that there are a lot of repeat people who go back to Lech over and over again, but that's more than I've got on me.
I think, you know, I think there's a couple folks that are approaching a year in the cave, 52 weeks.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. No, somebody put together a list. Maybe that was Hazel Barton and Derek Bristol of like who've been in the most times. And I'm not even in the top like 50 at 19 weeks. Pat Cambyses, I think she's like, she's over 6 months now, I think 27 or 28 weeks in the cave. Just over the years, people just keep going back and it's added up. I would guess Peter Bosted probably. He's probably, oh gosh, I bet he's approaching a year or something the cave. So, I mean, people have been going in since, what was it, 89?
Yeah.
On a regular basis, oftentimes a couple of 3 weeks a year, and it's just added up for a lot of people. So, people have spent some real time in Lech.
When was your first time in there?
1990.
Okay, so right after.
Yeah, I wasn't the first. When I got there was about 40 miles surveyed on my first trip, and then they passed 50 not long after.
Okay.
So I was not there right off the bat. I was there for Emily Davis's rescue.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a very entertaining time. I mean, luckily, Emily was stable and, you know, doing okay, and we knew we were going to get her out. So that meant us cavers could relax a little bit and have a lot of fun. It was kind of like a big caver homecoming, that rescue. There were so many people from all over the country who came out to help.
I talked to her about that, and it seemed to me like she was sick of telling the story. And I was just like, you got to tell it one more time, you know, for the podcast. Then everybody will hear it here.
I'm sure she's told it a million times.
And anyone who wants a more detailed account can check out Deep Secrets, which is a great book.
Yeah. Yeah. It's super written up in there. So all the details are in there, but it was, and it may sound weird, but we had a great time during that rescue. And of course, we were all volunteering. Now, at that time, I was kind of still a college student and didn't have a lot of money. And at one point in time, we came out of the cave and the park told us they were going to pay us for working on the rescue. And we were like flabbergasted, like, we're going to get paid for this? You know, we couldn't believe it.
Wow. Getting paid to go caving. Wow.
Yeah, getting paid to help get Emily out of the hole, you know, so... So we had a good time during the rescue, and largely because we knew Emily was fine. You know, well, not fine, but we knew it wasn't life threatening. We knew she was going to get out safely, and so we didn't have to worry about her health situations, and we could, you know, just make sure everything was rigged and the cave was ready and everything was prepared, and then we hung out and shot the breeze with old friends.
Yeah, it was just going to take time, just time.
It was just going to take time. Yeah, it just took time. It's a long way to go, and there's a lot of obstacles on the way.
So of all that time in Lech, I don't know, what can you, I don't want to say put your name on, but what were you there for, would you say, that people maybe have heard of?
You know, some of the things that I've been involved in, I mean, I helped draft some of the quads for a good number of years. Hmm. You know, I've worked in the Far East a fair bit, but I've not been involved as many discoveries as some other folks. The main area that I helped find was kind of Red Sea, Dead Sea, Needle Park Maze, that part of the cave. We surveyed several miles in that area over the course of a few years. And actually, we found, myself and Rosano Bascarino from Puerto Rico, he and I found the Red Sea about 6 hours before Emily broke her leg.
Oh, man. And so you were in the cave when it happened. You
know, well, we were camped right next to Emily.
Wow.
We were in the same camp at Deep Seas. And so they'd gone off to Fubar where Emily got hurt. And we'd found this new area, and of course we were dying to go survey it and get going, but that all went on hold for the rescue. We didn't get back to it for about another 6 months or something.
But you were the one who got back to it when the time came?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, great.
There was another group working up in Needle Park. But yeah, we continued that, and we did some climbs in the area, and I got up to Pool Hall and some other higher level parts of the cave there. So yeah, we definitely stayed involved with that part of the cave.
You going to be going back anytime soon?
Well, we'll see. Everything in Carlsbad is closed right now because of concern about COVID impact on bats. I'm not the only one who's not happy about it, but I do very much hope to go back to Carlsbad. I have some projects in the park. I have some improved research permits, and I want to hopefully we can continue that stuff in the future.
Okay.
So I assume at some point in time, the park will let the cavers back in. We'll see what happens.
I'm glad to hear that book is not closed for you and that you might be heading back in.
Oh, I'm definitely hoping for it, and I'm sure not the only one. And of course, it's not just Lechuguilla. I mean, there's well over 100 caves in the park. A lot of them are kind of hush-hush, but there's a lot of other things going on there.
Exciting.
Yeah, it is exciting if we can ever get back in there.
You know what? I don't know why, but this is like the first I'm realizing that, you know, COVID came from bats and we got to keep the COVID away from the bats. I don't know why I didn't make the connection.
It's a big concern for our cave biologists, for sure. I've heard about it from a number of folks, you know, and the Park Service is trying to be responsible and trying to make sure everything's good. It's a really major bat site at Carlsbad in multiple caves. So it's they feel like it's an important responsibility of theirs. So we'll see about that. Yeah, I don't know what it is that will make them comfortable with allowing the cavers back, but I sure hope something.
No kidding. So, I mean, I'm completely out of the loop here. Is the main, you know, Carlsbad, has that been closed too? No one's been there?
There definitely are plenty of tours going on.
Okay, in the common areas.
But yeah, but I believe even cavers who had projects in Carlsbad Caverns, I don't think they're letting them off the trail to go do their projects. I don't think that's the case.
Oh, wow.
There certainly are research. Well, there's still mapping and exploration going on in Carlsbad. CRF is active there with restoration and cleanup. I think there are plenty of people that like to be doing stuff in the cave, but I don't think it's happening right now. Maybe I'm wrong.
Okay. I've talked to a few Wigpistle cavers. So you've been out this way, out east, to do some work there in Kentucky?
Yeah. Well, I did my master's degree at Western Kentucky University. And I switched. My undergraduate was in journalism, and then I just did not have the science background I needed to be a cave specialist for the Park Service. And so I went back to school and got a master's in hydrology. And, you know, my thesis work was on karst hydrology at Sequoia National Park. So that was my original introduction to kind of being in Kentucky and caving there. And during that time I was there, we got the Wigpistle project going. And we've generally been going back once or twice a year for the last 15 years. We were last there in August, and I'll be going back again in March. And we're planning on a bigger trip this year for October.
So if you could, I guess, boil down Wigpistle for people who aren't familiar. I mean, it's a long cave in Kentucky, right?
Yeah, it's right next door to Mammoth, and it's hydrologically connected. So the river in Mammoth is the same river. Well, the river in upstream Mammoth, not Echo River, is the same river that appears in Wigpistle. So they're right next door. So really, in terms of the water, it's another part of the Mammoth Cave system. And so really, it's kind of classic, normal, central Kentucky stuff. You got lower level trunks with a lot of water sometimes and rivers and streams, a lot of canyons. But then you also have a lot of old upper level stuff that's now dry, including, you know, abandoned boreholes and abandoned canyons. And things are very, you know, interconnected. The water never seemed like it could make up its mind for very long and, you know, kept diverging and bifurcating and going to new places. So it's another complex, multi-level, you know, Mammoth Cave sort of system. The cave was originally explored back in the late 70s and early 80s by employees of the National Park Service working for Jim Quinlan, the hydrologist at Mammoth Cave.
Yeah.
Jim wanted them to find where all these cave rivers were. And they did that by, oh gosh, those again, these are still very well-known NSS cavers, Don Kuhn, Sherry Engler, Gary Schindel, our former NSS president, mm-hmm. Steve Newton, and lots of other people worked for the park at that time and did this work. And they mapped, it probably mapped nearly 100 miles in those years. They mapped, 20 miles in Wigpistle and just all over the place, a 5-mile cave here, a 10-mile cave there, incredibly productive. And so when we came in, that work had been done. And then also some other cavers had connected in a couple of other caves to Wigpistle. John Jasper and Alan Glennon, they had connected in Martin Ridge Cave and also Jackpot Cave, which had been explored by the James Cavers. Very active group in the Mammoth Cave area. A lot of folks from Indiana. They've done a huge amount there over the decades.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we had this sort of three caves that were kind of one cave, but the surveys weren't connected. You know, they hadn't sort of been integrated. So that was one of our first big tasks, was to kind of get the caves integrated, complete the surveys between the different sections of the cave, integrate the surveys. And then we sort of just tried to dive in and work the system, so to speak, and look for all the leads that have been left behind. Now, the guys back in the Quinlan years, very strong, capable cavers. They, you know, not much deterred them. Water didn't deter them. Tight spots definitely didn't deter them. But they didn't do a lot of vertical work. And so we're finding that a lot of our good leads now are climbs or pits. So a lot of times that's what we're doing at Wigpistle, is going down the pits and seeing what's down there, or working on climbs to get up to upper levels, often canyons that we can see in the walls of the domes. So that's where a lot of our weak pistol work is now in terms of, you know, following forward from what those guys had done. And it's a productive area. I mean, we always have plenty to survey. We always have plenty of leads. You know, we haven't had huge multiple mile long breakouts, but we certainly have trips that get 500 feet, 1,000 feet or more of survey. So it's a fun place to go. There's lots to do. We work a lot with Pat Cambyses. You know, Pat is the manager of the Cave Research Foundation facility there at Mammoth Cave. So we often stay there or stay with Pat, and she's kind of our local contact and local person and stuff. So she's, her presence there is really is a key part of the success of the project.
So, I mean, hydrologically connected to Mammoth. So if any connection is going to be found that will admit a human, it will be in this vertical element, or has that been looked at closely enough?
You know, we don't have any passage that's particularly close, nor anything that's sort of strongly heading the Mammoth Cave direction.
Okay, so it's pretty well separated. Okay.
It's pretty well separated. But what there is there's one of those giant sinkholes, deep sinkholes that you get in the Mammoth Cave area between Big Pistol and the Proctor part of Mammoth. So I'm guessing, I mean, if I say this, it probably means I'll be proven wrong at some point. But probably if a connection is ever made, it'll be the divers that'll do it.
Gotcha.
And there are people interested in that. But whether you're on the Mammoth Cave side or on the Weak Pistol side, it's a really, really long trip to get the tanks in there.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
So it's a little daunting for a dive project. But people are talking about it and thinking about it.
Very exciting indeed.
Yeah, it is exciting. I think people got a little nervous recently, because, of course, the second longest cave in the world is down in Quintana Roo, Mexico right now. And right next door are some other very long caves. And some of the people who have been working in those caves in Mexico were talking about connecting two of them. And if they accomplish that, that will become the longest cave in the world.
Ooh.
Yeah. So for the first time, really kind of, at least since back in the 70s, before Mammoth and Flint Ridge were connected, Mammoth actually has competition now to be the longest cave on the planet. And so I think the Mammoth folks and the people who've caved there for decades are like, no, we can't let Mammoth be second. So there was more interest in connecting in Weak Pistol, you know, and bringing that 40 miles of Weak Pistol cave, you know, into the Mammoth Cave list, so to speak, and extending Mammoth Cave by 40 miles so that it would not be second longest if they connected those two caves in Quintana Roo. I don't think that connection is imminent from what I understand, but it's a possibility. So
need to get those Fisher Ridge people to turn over their data and find that connection.
People are interested in that too. Although I think, you know, it changes things when you get subsumed by Mammoth, as the Rappel Cave people found out. You know, I think that's worked out well, but people were nervous about, you know, suddenly you're part of Mammoth Cave and your project's kind of their project and your project's kind of part of that project now. And, you know, it's a big change, not just in terms of understanding the caves, but also for the cavers on their projects when things are connected.
Indeed. Wow. So I've talked to some California cavers before, and, you know, what I hear sometimes is that for as big a state as California is, not a lot of caves, but it seems like you've looked at your fair share in the Sierra Nevada.
Oh, yeah. I think there's more caves in California than people realize or give it credit for, particularly when you include the lava tube component.
Oh, of course.
We're in Shasta County, which is, probably got, I'll say, several hundred caves. But just north of here is Siskiyou County, and they're more like 2,000 with the lava tubes that they're probably working their way up to. And there's a lot in the Sierras, and there's still going to be a lot more found in California. There's going to be a lot more found across the West. I think probably still in the East even, too, because it's rugged, it's steep, it's remote. You can only get up there, you know, up into the mountains of California, summer and fall. And there's a lot of limestone out there. Gosh, places like Montana and Idaho, there's so much limestone out there. Nevada, too, that I think we're going to have a lot more caving out on the western U.S. California and the other states also. There's still a ton to find out here. So I think it's more than people realize in California, and I think we're going to continue to find a lot more out here.
It's just so vast and remote. You got to have hardy people out there doing that. You can't just park and walk for a couple hours. You got to be out there for a long time.
You got to backpack in most of these places. You know, it's like a minimum of a 3-4-5 day commitment. And then, of course, you're hauling ropes and vertical gear and your caving gear and your camping gear, and the packs are really heavy. I mean, the classic place up here is the Marble Mountains. You know, think about the big projects in Montana. Yeah, it's a lot of work, but long before you get to the cave.
Yeah. I mean, Tears of the Turtle. I mean, you got to like backpack 20 miles, maybe even bring an animal to carry stuff, you know, and then you're there for a week, 2 weeks.
And really, that's sort of how it works in the Marble Mountains here in California. That's how it works sometimes in some parts of Sequoia in the Sierras. They aren't quite as we're not going for the deepest cave in the country, but there's a lot of that happening in other parts of the West, too, because people are trying to get out there and see what they can find.
Yeah, cave's a cave. You got to find them.
And I like little caves just as much as big caves, so I'm not disappointed. You know what it is. You find tiny little things that maybe you maybe have to find 20 of those before you find a real cave, and then you have to find 20 little caves before you find a medium-sized cave, and then find 20 medium-sized caves before you find a big cave or something like that. But I'm not disappointed when we find the little ones. You know, I'm interested in the cave features, the cave biology, and even little caves often have cool things in them.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of remote and vast Nevada, you've done some work there. Eastern Nevada specifically?
Yeah, that's where most of the limestone is. Yeah, driving around Nevada is just, it kind of, if you're a ridge walker or a person who wants to find caves, it's just kind of frustrating. It's like, look, oh, another 40-mile-long mountain range. It's all limestone. Except I can't get there. You know, there's no trails. There's no roads to go anywhere near it. It's remote. It's like, you know, to just even get started, you got to like hike in there and spend a week. And of course, you know, people are doing that, though. Adam Haydock, he's been finding a lot of stuff around Vegas and doing the time and finding things. And it pays off. You know, you may spend weeks out there and not find much, but one day you're going to find something and you'll be glad you did. And I think it's going to keep happening in the West.
Well, what's the best time to do that, I guess? I mean, when you're talking about Nevada, you're talking about the desert. If you're out at the wrong time of year, you're talking about exposure risk and things like that. When do you go and do that?
Well, it is a trick. You know, if you're going, it's all about the elevation in the West.
Yeah, okay.
You know, one of our caving areas here, you know, the limestone's, say, between 500 feet and 2,000 feet in elevation. So low enough, you can get out there in the winter. And but a lot of things are at higher elevation, and so you can't go in the winter. Now, in the case of Nevada, say in the Ely area in eastern Nevada, that's kind of high desert. You can get out in the summers. It's not too hot. But when you get further south towards Vegas, down where Adam is, that's lower elevation. It's hot. And so you got to go early in the morning. You got to go in the evenings. You got to wait till fall or winter. So it really kind of varies place to place in the West, just depending upon the local climate. Certainly up in Montana, I mean, you can forget it until about July because there's just too much leftover snow. So up there, you know, we have a project going in Idaho, September, October, kind of really good months to be there. And that's true here, too, in the Klamath Mountains with the marbles and things and the other work we've been doing. Generally, you hope things are kind of melted out with the snow by July 4th, but some years it's not, and you have to wait till even later. So it's, you know, late summer and fall for those higher elevation caves. And then winter rolls in again and you're done until the next year. So we try to get a lot done quick in the falls.
You've got a current project going in the Klamath Mountains, right?
Yeah, we have a Cave Research Foundation Klamath Mountains project. Yep.
Yeah. What's been going on there?
Lots of great stuff. You know, we haven't the Klamath Mountains is best known in terms of caving for the marbles where Bigfoot is. But there's actually a lot of other limestone out there. So we've been doing a lot of ridge walking, finding a bunch of caves, going back to other known caving areas and finding new stuff. Particularly productive for us has been the McLeod limestone, which is a Permian limestone that's here in Shasta County. Very steep, very rough terrain, hard to get around. But we've been taking the time to do that, and it's really been paying off. So we've got a whole suite of new caves in the McLeod limestone. There's some really pretty caves in the McLeod. They tend to have a lot of really significant paleontology. There's a lot of Native American use in the McLeod caves. So there's a lot of important resources in the caves that we have to be careful of. But one of our newer finds of the cave, we've been naming caves after months, is the October caves, which we found last year. Really nice. We integrated those three caves into one. Big rooms, well decorated. We got ancient animal remains incorporated into the flowstone. Really nice cave, a lot of nice rope work, but super delicate. So we got to be very careful.
Very exciting. I mean, if we looked at your list of international projects, we'd be here all day. But the stuff you're working on now seems super interesting. Down in Jamaica?
Yeah, we're trying to get that going again. Jamaica is an island that's beautiful and has a lot of remote, beautiful tropical mountains. And a lot of caving trips have gone there. There's been multiple British expeditions. There was an American expedition. The Jamaicans are really caving a lot. But it's 80% of the island's karst. And wow. It's a big island. So there's a really well-known book, Jamaican Underground, a great documentation on the caves there. It lists about 1,000 caves. I'll guess there's triple that many actually in the country, if not more. There are deep pits. I mean, it's like tag in places, big, deep holes, beautiful stuff, waterfalls. They have some really long diatraces, like 10-mile-long diatraces that have been done by some of the British and by some of the caving groups down there. So a lot has been done in Jamaica, but there's also still a whole lot to do. So we're really working to try to integrate our project with the local Jamaican folks and the Jamaican Caving Organization. So we're doing a lot of communication right now and talking about what we want to do down there and what they want to see done down there. You know, because whenever you go international, you've got to be friends with the people. You got to respect their country, their ways, how they do things. So you always have a lot to learn. You know, when you get there, you got to be all open. You got to be all listening and understand their concerns so they can let you do your thing that you want to go and accomplish. So we're in kind of that stage, I think, with Jamaica, understanding what's been done, learning more about the past there, integrating with the local cavers. And so we hope to go back in July, hopefully for about 3 weeks, and hit a couple of areas on kind of the west half of the island where there's a lot of cave mapping to be done, as well as some cave science. Pat Cambyses is really interested in the island in terms of the origin of the caves. You know, Pat studies that, you know, what processes led to these particular caves forming. That seems to be very complex in Jamaica with multiple speleogenesis processes going on. So Pat's really interested in the science and learning where the caves came from down there. So we hope to have a multifaceted project, doing caving in several areas, working with the local cavers, doing cave mapping as well as cave science. So that's kind of what we're shooting for and aiming for. I was just in Jamaica in September to just kind of, it was my first trip. So I was with my wife, Heather. So she and I spent a lot of time just visiting some of the cave and karst areas, trying to meet some of the local people, but just laying the bare minimum kind of groundwork. We got a lot more to do in that way, but hopefully it'll all come together and we'll have a good new Jamaica project.
Yeah. The caving, I'm glad you brought up the diplomacy, because the caving diplomacy when you're working an international project is so important. And I've always been impressed with, you know, I've talked to a lot of Mexico cavers, you know, and just really kind of working that relationship with the people who are there, and some of whom are cavers, but many of them are not. And just making sure that they understand why you are there. And it was just so important. And if you want to go back, you got to make sure you work that.
You do. It's critical international stuff. It's just sort of, you know, the expanded version of landowner relations. And of course, a lot of times in other countries too, it's personal relationships, but it's also government permits. So usually when you're caving overseas, you've also got to do some paperwork to keep the folks on the government side, you know, happy with what you're doing. So there's always a lot of that kind of stuff when you're setting up new international projects. We've been working in the Philippines a lot, and they're very supportive and encouraging, great people to work with. But the beginning of every trip, I mean, there's an expedition there right now. It's days and days of meetings and visiting with the officials and shaking hands and giving presentations. But that's just how it goes. You know, that's what they need to feel good about what you're doing on their land and in their country. And so it's an investment. You develop those relationships. You let people understand what you're doing, and then you can keep going back and keep doing the work and enjoying the caves.
Yeah,
you've got to make that investment up front.
Joel, this has been such a delight. I really appreciate your time. Thank you for taking over the NSS News. It sounds like
Adam and I are both enjoying it, and it's great to work with Adam. And so I hope we make a good publication our membership can be proud of. Our members do so many amazing, great things. It's really nice to be able to champion that, you know, to put forth, you work hard on a caving project for 20 years and we can put that in the news. I think that's great. You know, we're taking what you've done that's super cool and letting everybody know about it. So that's a pleasure. That's just a really fun thing to do. And we're enjoying it. And hopefully we'll keep the membership happy with what we do.
So. Yeah. If you're an NSS member, and if you're not, become one. But if you are, read the daggone thing when it shows up in whatever inbox you get it in, whether it's your email or your physical mailbox. Read the thing. It's good. There's good stuff in there.
People are doing cool things out there, and we're going to try to champion that in the news.
Oh, my gosh. And when you're a not-much caver like me, you know, and you got kids at home and not a whole lot of time, it's just wonderful to go armchair caving with that thing.
It can be nice if you've got a busy life, you know, to at least be able to sit down for an hour and read about what somebody else has been able to do. It can be inspiring. It can be encouraging.
Super inspiring. Joel, thank you so much. This has been great.
Thank you, Matt. I appreciate it. It's good to be here and nice to be on your podcast. And thanks for doing your podcast. People love this thing. I hear about it all the time. So I feel very honored to be on it.
Man, thank you for that. Well, I mean, you're the guy, so I got to have you.
Well, you're the guy. You're the guy with the podcast, so I'm happy to be here.
All right, Joel, take care. We'll see you out there.
Thanks a lot, man. Take good care. Thank you very much, and hopefully, we'll go caving sometime.
I'd love it. Oh man, thank you, Joel. What a good talk, and what a good communicator. I think that we are in great hands with Joel at the helm of the NSS News, and Adam, for that matter, Adam Weaver. Can't wait to see what the NSS News looks like with them moving forward. Next month, I've got a lot of interviews done and more coming this month. I think I've got an interview every week this coming month, so I'm banking them up in February, thank goodness. And the next one you'll hear on March 1st will be Kelly Smallwood, tag caver, cancer survivor. We talk a lot about that, and she has been involved in some fascinating projects, and we will hear about it on March 1st. Hope you'll be here for it. Thanks again to our sponsor, Sophie Reaptress. You can get a custom cave suit from Sophie. Click the link in the show notes. Thanks to our past sponsors, Swago, get you a nice shiny Swago pack. Organic Robot Designs, get some t-shirts ordered up for your grotto. Nice fundraiser. Charlie does a great job in Greenfield, Indiana. Thanks to Elspelio, great lights now being sold by OnRope One. And I think that's about it. Is that it? I think so. I don't know if I'm going caving this month. I hope so. But, you know, if I don't, it's not the end of the world. I went twice in January, and that's pretty good for me. So maybe that'll be that. All right. I'm Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. And until next time, kill nothing but time.